Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern. I am joined by Heidi White, Tim McIntosh. Heidi and Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
Thank you, David.
We are here to discuss Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It. We talked about the first half last week. We will talk about, you know, since this is the way halves work, we will talk about the second half this week. And then next week, we will answer your questions. Before we do that, though, I want to remind you how you can get in touch and share your questions with us. You can do that on Facebook, on the Close Reads podcast discussion group. Just search those words in the search bar on Facebook and you will find us if you have not already joined. If you have joined, make sure that you share your questions, post your questions on the thread there. You can also shoot us an email at closereadspodcasts@gmail.com. And you can also follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at closereadspods.
Hey, David.
Yes, sir.
I was on Overcast. That's how I listen to my podcasts. So I was on Overcast the other day and I thought, I'm going to search Close Reads and see how we're doing over there. And we had all 5-star ratings, but we only had, I think, 5 of them.
Man, there's either two things going on here. One, people aren't using Overcast.
Yeah.
Or two, Overcast listeners are not helping us out here. They're not. There's 5 of them, but I mean,
there could be 7.
Yeah, I mean, the other 2 of you need to get on the ball and give us a review. I'm just shaking my head. You can't see me, but I'm shaking my head.
SMH.
Well, yeah, we are here to discuss River Runs Through It. Next, we're going to talk about Leif Enger's Peace Like a River. So be prepared for that. That will start, I guess, the week after next. And that will take us into the new year, at which point we will do a few weeks on the infamous Catcher in the Rye by Salinger. So that's what's coming up. I was going to say something. I'm going to hold off on that though.
I'm so curious.
Should we publicly say what we've said on social media? We should go ahead and say it on the podcast.
Yeah. Why not? Right.
Okay.
Why not?
All right. Let's do it. So for those of you who are Patreon followers, we have a little, special thing coming up in the new year. If you are giving it to $5 or higher level, $5 a month, then you're going to be able to join us as we discuss Crime and Punishment. We're going to be discussing that from the end of January into June. We're going to take our sweet time. It's a very long book, but you know, people have been asking for it, asking for some good Russian dourness as we, you know, they've been asking for that for a long time. So we figured, you know, we can do dour. So we will do that, but we wanted to be able to also offer, you know, the regular show, because not everyone wants to read the same book for 6 months. It's just not in the cards for everybody. So we will be offering the regular show, but then also for our Patreon listeners, you can join the conversation as we go through Crime and Punishment. And then after that, for the second half of the year, in terms of our approach to dour long books, we're going to do some Charles Dickens after that for the second half of the year. So if you want to join the conversation there, you can go to Patreon. That's patreon.com/closereads, and you can join us. So like I said, that will be the end of January will be when we will be kicking that off. And we are going to be, at least for us here on the show, we're going to be using the new translation by Michael Katz. Tim, I know we're going to see you this weekend, and I've got your copy sitting on my desk here, ready to pass off to you.
I'm happy about that.
So I haven't read that translation right here in my hand.
Heidi already has hers. So
I cannot wait to do this book. It is like, this is going to be so fun. I mean, fun. I use the term loosely because it's, you know, darkness.
Yeah. Someone said, why are you doing this starting in the winter? And I thought to myself, because that's when the new year starts.
That's right. Because we hate ourselves. That's why.
But that means that we have the Patreon episodes on Crime and Punishment and then Dickens. We also have the regular show. So the 8 books that we're going to be covering there for this year. And then we also have, of course, the plays, the thing, with lots of good plays there. So I think we're starting with, which one are we starting with, Tim? Remind me on the place thing.
As You Like It.
As You Like It. That's right. Yeah. And when do those episodes start?
The new year.
All right. So with the new year comes resolutions, and lots of us have reading resolutions. So I was going to say checked off the boxes, but that would assume that you have finished accomplished your resolutions. We've at least started the list of New Year's resolutions related to reading for you. So, you know, the work's done. Just get reading. That's basically, you know, get reading, get listening, and join the conversation. Pretty easy, right? There's no work involved in that at all. But speaking of there being no work, let's chat about A River Runs Through It, because as we know, this is not a job.
Nice transition. Yes.
A little forced, but you know, I was thinking a lot about how I would categorize this book. Like, I mean, there's the obvious bits of genre, you know, it's kind of a Western book. It's a family book. It's a fishing book, outdoorsman book, whatever. There's all these different genres you can categorize it. But I was reading somewhere where someone was calling it, I think the word was a tragedy. And it occurred to me that I got to the end of it and I didn't really think, boy, that's tragic. But then I thought, well, maybe that's the wrong, maybe that's the wrong approach. Maybe it is a tragedy. So I wanted to ask you, when you get to the end of this book, you've read it multiple times, both of you. Do you think of this as a tragedy? Tim, you've read it the most. You've read it for the longest number of years. Do you think of this as a tragedy?
I do, but I share your reluctance to just plop it in that category, because I think there's something really, for me, joyful at the end. Whereas, so a tragedy, usually at the end of a tragedy, let's say Macbeth, or let's mm-hmm. say Thomas Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities, there's something like a feeling of having been stripped clean in some way for me. Mm-hmm. And this doesn't feel like that. Like in Macbeth, things have been put in their right order. Macbeth has been deposed, and you know, the right king has been, or another better king is going to inherit the throne. And just like the disgustingness of Macbeth's rule, the darkness of his rule has been put away. And then you get done. And for me, I feel like I've taken a hot scouring bath. But at the end of this book, it's tragic in that we lose Paul. Paul dies under somewhat mysterious circumstances, but we can put it together. And there's nothing, it doesn't feel like justice has been served. It feels like just a beautiful artist was lost in his prime. And so it feels more mournful than it feels just in, oh gosh, what's the right word? Cathartic.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's tragic, but I'm not sure I would call it a tragedy, although there are some elements of a literary tragedy. And I think we're probably using it in a technical way here when we're saying, you know, kind of the Aristotelian idea of the tragic hero at the center who makes a decision or a series of decisions based on hubris or pride or whatever is fatal flaw is, and then reaps the consequences of it. And with those consequences comes a reordering of the society, which I do think there are some elements of that. But I agree with Tim that at the end of this story with Paul's, the memory at least of Paul's death, which we don't even get to see in real time in the story, there's not that sense of restoring of the proper world, a reordering of a proper society. Justice has not necessarily been done. It just feels empty. To me, it feels more like a memoir than a tragedy. But there's definitely tragic.
What do you mean by
it feels
that?
Tragic. It feels like a memory novel to me. That kind of along with those allegorical, it's unique. There's all of this allegory in it, or a metaphor, if you want to, if you don't want to call it an allegory, at least it's very metaphorical. It kind of goes into these mysteries of life through the metaphor of fishing. But did y'all ever watch what's that zombie show? You know what I'm talking about.
Walking Dead?
Yes, thank you. That's embarrassing. But okay, so Walking Dead.
Is it?
When it first came out, Scott and I would always say, it's not about zombies, it's about relationships. And that became like a joke to us. So whenever we're trying to act smart about TV shows, we always just say, oh, you know, it's not about zombies, it's about relationships. And that's, but there's a little bit of that in this novel, right? It's not about fishing, it's about relationships, but it is about fishing. And so it's very layered. Whereas a tragedy, although it does have those layers, has more of a straightforward kind of plot cycle to it.
Mm.
There's something about, I keep returning to Macbeth because we recently read it on The Play's the Thing, and it's hopefully a familiar tragedy to most people that listen to this show. So much of Act 5 of Macbeth is spent in pursuit of Macbeth. We see the army coming. We see the army coming. We see Macduff at the gates. We see the fight between Macduff and his opposers. And it's all going toward this climactic end, which is and has to be, because of the structure of the play, Macbeth's death. But I just want to read the last paragraph of. I want to read the paragraph in which we find out that Paul has been killed, and back up from there. So here's the paragraph. For me, it's on page 102. A river, though, has so many things to say that it is hard to know what it says to each of us. As we were packing our tackle and fish in the car, Paul repeated, "Just give me 3 more years." At the time, I was surprised at the repetition. But later I realized that the river somewhere, sometime, must have told me, too, that we would receive no such gift. For when the police sergeant early next May wakened me before daybreak, I rose and asked no questions. Together we drove across the Continental Divide and down the length of the Big Blackfoot River, over forest floors yellow and sometimes white with glacier lilies, to tell my father and mother that my brother had been beaten to death by the butt of a revolver and his body dumped in an alley. I actually want to just read the next paragraph also, mm-hmm. because it's really sad. My mother turned and went to her bedroom where, in a house full of men and rods and rifles, she had faced most of her great problems alone. She was never to ask me a question about the man she loved most and understood least. Perhaps she knew enough to know that for her, it was enough to have loved him. He was probably the only man in the world who had held her in his arms and leaned back and laughed. Previous to that point, Paul, we don't see Paul fleeing death. In fact, we see just the opposite. We see him pursuing life through this incredible gift that he has, this incredible art that he's mastered. And so that's part of the reason why, to me, I think it's not a celebration of a bad man's end. It's a celebration of, how do we describe Paul? Of an imperfect man, an imperfect but beautiful man's end. And the last thing that we see him doing when his craft, and it's absolutely majestic. He's doing something that no one, these other great master fishermen, have never seen before.
All right. Well, we had a few technical problems with Tim's line, so we called him on his phone. So he'll sound like he's on the phone, but you know, you talk on the phone, so it should be okay. So one thing I was thinking about is how maybe it doesn't feel so much like a tragedy, or the tragic elements don't weigh on us as much because we're kind of told early on more or less what's going to happen. like the narrator tells us, he kind of drops these hints throughout the whole thing that Paul's kind of doomed. There's moments like, this was the last time we caught the fish. And he kind of, you know, this was our last trip together and so on. And so he kind of builds up to it. So that might play into it a little bit in terms of this sense of there's a sense of foreboding, but that means that when we get to the end, mm-hmm. the tragedy doesn't sort of weigh on us like a heaviness or a sickness or something the way it does, say, in certain other novels.
But David, isn't that true of, I don't know that there's a tragedy that doesn't do that. I mean, I think that all of the books that we'd point to, we'd say that's a straight up tragedy. No chaser, you know. I think we would say, boy, we saw the end coming. We saw the force of Dunsinane, you know, arriving to Macbeth's castle. I think there are little things. So I'm not sure that that's the thing that makes it not square up with feeling like a tragedy, meaning a river runs through it seems a little bit different. And I'm not sure if it's because we were well prepared. I feel like in every great tragedy, we're well. I feel like in the books that we would point to and say, yeah, that's a tragedy, we're well prepared for the demise of the antagonist or the protagonist.
Is there a fine line, though, between, say, foreshadowing and the fact that this narrator specifically comes right out and tells us he's not going to make it? Are you?
Well, I think in a true tragedy, something like Macbeth, there's something inherently flawed within the trajectory of the character's development that communicates the world. Although you might have a love for the character, that the world is better off without it, that the center cannot hold with this of the world of the story without this character being removed from the society, that they must be. But that's not the way it is in A River Runs Through It. There's something very deeply flawed in Paul, but there's also something very deeply flawed in Neil. And it's almost the same thing, just manifested differently. And yet Neil goes on and lives and Paul doesn't. So there is this question of why, though? And that is not the question of a tragedy. It's very clear throughout a tragedy why this character has to go, but not in this book. And so yes, it's tragic, but it's not technically a tragedy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about the comparison between Neil and Paul. I mean, it is by the end of the book, I don't find much of anything compelling about Neil. And I don't think I'm supposed to find anything compelling about Neil. He sucks everyone's time. He is ignorant of the incredible gift that Paul has. He just doesn't even notice. He's too busy falling asleep with Rawhide and like getting sun poisoned. I mean, he doesn't have eyes to see, and it's partly because he has not trained himself to see. And yes, Heidi, at the end, Paul dies.
Right.
Paul, the great master. I mean, just a beautiful, just like a living artwork. He dies, and Neil goes back to college with his two sweaters. And kind of doesn't know the difference, doesn't have any idea about what he's missed or missing. And it's not put right. Unlike most tragedies, it's not put right. At the end of Oedipus Rex, we see the tragedy coming. We see the fall of the great king. We see the errors in him. And at the conclusion, the king is deposed. He throws himself out of the kingdom and order is restored. Presumably the great plague leaves the city and things are well again. It's not that way in this book. It just feels like there is a gap in this family and the gap cannot be explained, and it feels like it's nothing but loss. But the thing that feels to me that's a little bit redemptive about it is the art of Paul's life. It's not that society is put in its right order again, but there was something about his life, like his father says at the end, but it's probably worth reading, that he was beautiful. And there's a memory of that in some ways just casts a kind of silver light over the entire book for me.
I completely agree with that, Tim. And I think, you know, we all talk about how much we love this book. I love this. I love the end of this story because it doesn't tie everything up in a neat little bow. There's just this dot, 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 this dun, dun, dun of mystery at the end. Very, very human. But at the same time, the whole book with this fishing metaphor explores the fact that life is mysterious, that life is hard, that life has depths to it, that the best we can do is send out strands of lures to try to connect some way with the depth, but that we can't ever really master it, you know? And so to your point about reading it, I do want to read a little bit. On my book, it's on page 103, and I'm going to read two paragraphs.
It's the same section I bet that I was going to read.
Probably, Heidi. Because it's just so,
it's great, yeah.
It's so beautiful. Starting with "Once My Father." "Once my father came back with another question. 'Do you think I could have helped him?' he asked. 'Even if I might have thought longer, I would have made the same answer. 'Do you think I could have helped him?' I answered." I just want to pause because that's so beautiful. That whole, he answers the question with a question and calls it an answer. And that's human life. Like that is human life. "We stood waiting in deference to each other. 'How can a question be answered that asks a lifetime of questions?' After a long time, he came with something he must have wanted to ask from the first. 'Do you think it was just a stick up and foolishly he tried to fight his way out? You know what I mean? That it wasn't connected with anything in his past?' 'The police don't know,' I said. 'But do you?' he asked, and I felt the implication. 'I've said I've told you all I know. If you push me far enough, all I really know is that he was a fine fisherman.' 'You know more than that,' my father said. 'He was beautiful.' 'Yes,' I said. 'He was beautiful. He should have been. You taught him.' My father looked at me for a long time. He just looked at me. So this was the last he and I ever said to each other about Paul's death." That is maybe one of the most perfect pages of writing I've ever read in my entire life. Everything about that is perfect. Every word says something, multiple layers. And that, this is to what, to your point about Paul's beauty, really what the eulogy, the memory that Norman MacLean holds about his brother that is redemptive is that he was a fine fisherman. Because there's, because of all that fishing represents in the story, and because of this connection between mystery and nature and art and faith, that all of that goes to Paul out there fishing. And that's why Neil is different from Paul, right? Because Neil didn't bother to do it. But Paul was out there fishing his entire life. And that's the thing we remember about him, all that that represents in the story. And that's why even though his death feels so sad and there's so much grief to it, it's also, it is not a nihilistic story. It's not. There's a redemption to it that you can't put into words, but that's the whole story, right? There's this these layers of mystery that you can't say it because it belongs in a story.
Well, it takes the ending takes us back to the beginning, right? Yeah. Because as we talked about last week, it begins with "in our family," which is important. "In our family, there was no clear line between religion and fly fishing. We lived at the junction of the great trout rivers in western Montana, and our father was a Presbyterian minister and a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others." That takes us back to what you just read, right? If you push me far enough, all I really know is that he was a fine fisherman. And we're told at the beginning that there's no clear line between religion and fishing. And so when he says, all that I really know is he was a fine fisherman, he's you know, implicitly the book is, he's saying something about, you know, I don't know if he would say that he's a religious man, but he's saying something about, you know, his brother's soul when he says that. And then it says he was, yes, he was beautiful. He should have been. You taught him. That takes us back there again, right? Our father was a fly fisherman who tied his own flies and taught others. So the connections between the beginning and the end are really interesting because they tell us so much about what this book is really about, what the book is really trying to say. And Tim, I wanted to ask you something. You've read this book a lot. Mm-hmm. This might seem like a question that's not related, but I think it's very related. Why is this book the length that it is? Why not a novel? Why not give us more of, you know, the scene where Paul dies? Why not give us more of his life? Why not give us, you know, more of these relationships and these connections? Why not give us more of Neil later? Why not make this kind of, there's enough character here. There's enough theme here, and there's enough story here to give us a sort of,
yeah,
you know, at least like kind of like a piece, like a River style book or a Wendell Berry book where, you know, he could get 250 pages of a great novel out of this. And we obviously know he's got the chops for it. So why do you think he made the choice to keep it this length, around 100 pages and just a novella?
I think that the absence or the absences within the tale are like so bright that I think that if the book was 200 pages, it would kind of threaten to diminish the brightness of those absences. Meaning, on the next page after what Heidi read, so much of what Heidi read is about these two men who loved Paul, not understanding him. And then it's followed up by, once my father asked me a series of questions that suddenly made me wonder whether I understood even my father, whom I felt closer to than any man I have ever known. I just think there's so much of this story is about loving someone that you don't really understand, or loving something that you don't even really understand. And I think that the brevity of this book contributes toward that mysterious relationship of having affection for something and at the same time recognizing it is so big and so beyond me and of such a depth that I can't, though I love it, I don't really understand it. And I think the brevity contributes to that.
Hmm. Right. I agree. And I think also one of the big questions of this story that we haven't yet talked about is, and he never directly addresses, is this. Is there something that Paul understood about life that we don't? Is there something about him that, because he's the master of the art that's at the center of the story, and everybody watches him with awe. So there is this question throughout the story of maybe there's something that Paul got or understood or engaged in about life and being human that we're missing. And he doesn't seem to know what that is. You know, he just seems to be asking the question. Like, it's kind of threaded throughout the story and left unanswered.
You mean Norman doesn't understand, or yes, you mean Paul himself doesn't understand? No,
well, maybe Paul, but I met Norman. Because Paul, we've talked about Paul as Norman does, Norman the narrator, and the characters in the story talk about his personal life as though it has this flaw within it, which, you know, we do not endorse the things that Paul is doing. That's not what I'm saying. But then on the other side, his art, he's the master of, right? And then there's this gap between those two things. And the story kind of dwells in the gap there and the junctions. But the junctions are so key to the story. They're brought up from the very beginning. Fly fishing and religion are connected. So the implication then is if you are a master of fly fishing and all that that entails, that somehow you have some kind of connection to faith, to God, that is worth exploring. And I think that's part of the exploration of the novel, and yet it remains unanswered. And I think the brevity of the story contributes to kind of the dot, dot, dot in the reader's mind of, wow, maybe there's something Paul actually did understand that we don't get about life, about being human, about faith, about art, about nature.
Can I speculate about that for a second, Heidi?
Please.
It seems like the opening of this book, I'm going to read a passage and then I'm going to speculate on it. So for me, it's page 3. The last full paragraph begins, "Well, until man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back." Just as, by the way, having cast a fly rod many times, I cannot tell you how true that statement is. Like, if you are learning to fly cast, the thing that you want to do with everything, every fiber of your being, is like to just like rip the line as far back as you can go. And every time you do that, you end up with a snarl that is ungodly. So I just want to say this statement is true. "Well, until man is redeemed, he will always take a fly rod too far back, just as natural man always overswings with an axe or golf club and loses all his power somewhere in the air. Only with a rod, it's worse, because the fly often comes so far back it gets caught in a brush or a rock. When my father said it was an art that ended at 2 o'clock, he often added closer to 12 than to 2, meaning that the rod should be taken back only slightly farther than overhead, straight overhead, being 12 o'clock. Then, since it is natural for a man to try to attain power without recovering grace, he whips the line back and forth, making it whistle each way, and sometimes even snapping off the fly from the leader. But the power that was going to transport the little fly across the river somehow gets diverted into the building of a bird's nest of line, leader, and fly that falls out of the air into the water about 10 feet in front of the fisherman. If, though, he pictures the round trip of the line, transparent leader, and the fly from the top, and the fly from the time they leave the water until they return, they're easier to cast. They naturally come off as a water heavy line first and in front, and the light transparent lighter and fly trailing behind. But as they pass overhead, they have a little bit of time. So the light transparent leader." Okay. All of this is very specific direction. It's mathematical direction. It is about the art of fly casting, which is indeed a difficult art. The book is, I think this is part of my speculation. We have a Presbyterian minister who knows the way of redemption, that grace and salvation come through God's specific redemption, through Jesus, right? But so much of this book is about not the book of grace, not the book of, in Presbyterian language, not special revelation, but general revelation. Huh. It's about the book of nature. And I think what I see going on is that Paul understood the book of nature. He really understood the book of nature. He did not understand the book of grace. He did not understand the special revelation of God. He at least shows no indication that he did. But there's something about what Paul understood about nature and about the transformative power of his craft that even his father, who spent his life teaching the special revelation of God, somehow could see that Paul understood the general revelation of God in a way that nobody else that he knew understood it.
Hmm.
So I think that the theology of this book
is, it's a very, how do I say it? I do think there is a dichotomy between redemption by grace and redemption through nature. And I think that Paul understood the latter without understanding the former.
Maybe so. On page 42, which I think, Tim, you and I have the same version, but David has a different one. So sorry, David. This speaks to what you're saying within the metaphor of fishing. And this is when they first take Neil out, and Neil's hungover from his first night at the bar. And he's sitting with his Hills brother coffee can, which is a really cool little touch. Neil is, and then the brothers go, you know, Paul and Norman go out and find holes of their own. And Norman can't, he's not catching any because he's not willing to lose his flies. They're because the fish are under the willows, and he knows that if he tries to fish under there, that he's going to lose some flies. And so he keeps fishing in the sunny open water and not catching it. And Paul chastises him for it, says, if you want to catch fish, you have to go where the fish are. You have to be willing to go into the depths where the bottom feeders are, right? And so to your point, Paul has this ability to go into the deep water, to go into where the dwellers under the surface are. Like, he will go, he's willing to lose his flies. He's fine with that because he's out there to go under the surface. And over and over again, we see Norman unwilling to engage with those parts of his brother and of himself that are under the surface. He doesn't want to know about Paul's addiction. He doesn't want to know what the things that are happening. So he buries his head. He wants the sunny open water, but Paul will go there and engage in the mystery to get to the depths. And so I do think that the story is saying there's something about Paul, that there is the connection between the fallen nature of the world and the darkness lurking under the waters that Paul engages in, and it causes his death. And so, again, even to the readers, there's this great mystery to it. It's unresolved. It's it's answering the question with a question.
As a side note, I think it's fascinating that during the time that these events happened, Norman does not understand. But the story is told by Norman as an older man who's been presumably dwelling on this his entire life. And I think that he, by the end of his life, has come to a much greater understanding of his brother and what his and his brother's pursuit of those depths than he understood when he was a younger man during the time of Paul's death. And I think the story that we just read is that greater understanding. He in a way, he came to understand Paul better by dwelling on the mystery of him for all of those years after his death. He just kept dwelling on him and wondering about him. And I think this story is his way of trying to give an account of his brother's life.
Right.
The beautiful, not the, just the tragic aspects of it, but the real fullness of what his brother dedicated his life to.
Right. That all he really knows about him is that he's a fine fisherman. Right. Like, and all that fishing means within the story. That's a very meaningful, like, and the most meaningful benediction that you can give to Paul based on so many of the things that we've talked about, that to be a fine fisherman means you you are willing to lose flies to go under the willows to catch the fish, that there's this grace, that this intersection, this junction of nature and grace and power that that characterizes Paul on the river. And so I think the question that I keep having about Paul is Paul a man divided? Is he a man with this chasm between the Paul on the river and the Paul who's living this debauched life? Or is he a unified man, that they're both the same, right? That's the harmony. And so that's...
Say more about that, Heidi. How might they be the kind of the man who got into much trouble and the man on the river? How might they be united?
Well, they might not. It might be that he's a divided man, as we all are divided people.
Well, this concept of division is obviously something that the book is goes on and on about.
The great divide and the junctures. And a river itself, a river itself is a divide, and a river runs through it. That's the title. That's the point. Like, that's the thesis that, so it's hard to put into words because that's the whole story. I think that's the question of the story. I think that's the question that Norman, the narrator, continues to ask about his brother is it that the redeemed Paul was the Paul on the river and the fallen Paul is the one living this debauched life? Or is it that the debauched Paul is the same as the Paul on the river, that he's engaging in the depths of human existence? He's the one being honest about it, and everybody else is just fishing in the shallow water.
I think about the painter Caravaggio, who, oh my goodness. I mean, I just think Caravaggio's paintings are absolutely him. They just leap off the canvas in a way that maybe Rembrandt is the same way, but very few artists to me have this sort of like incandescent that Caravaggio's do. And so many of them have biblical subject matter. He is preoccupied with spiritual things. And the life that he was living was insane. He was murderous. And in many ways, he was vile. And it would be really, it's tempting to separate Caravaggio into two men, the one full of great spiritual longings and the one full of debauchery, and say they're kind of two different men. And yeah. Perhaps so, but I just don't know that Caravaggio could have produced, this is a hard thing to say, it's a hard thing to accept. I don't know that you could accept that Caravaggio, who produced those incredible paintings, I don't think he's a different man than the man who was murderous and vile and debauched. I think they're the same.
Right.
There's the same men. Clearly, there's a ravine somewhere in him. And I think clearly there's a ravine somewhere in Paul. But I also think, to your point, Heidi, I think the great mystery about Paul's character is whether or not he's like the things that he did on Sunday night were of the same tapestry as the things that he did on Saturday morning when he was on the river.
Right. Right. Well, and that seems to be the contemplation of the book, is that within every human soul, a river runs through it. There is this ribbon of divide and mystery that runs through every human soul and every human life and every complex web of human relationships. And so engage the mystery, like be there, be in the river.
I wanted to bring up the ending of the book, the final conversation he has with his father, because I think I don't want to say it summarizes, but it's definitely about what some of these things that you're talking about. the last page or so for, in my edition, it's 118, but it's, you know, just look at the end. There's a paragraph that says, indirectly, though he was present in many of our conversations. You guys see that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm going to read the next sentence and then down a little bit. Once, for instance, my father asked me a series of questions that suddenly made me wonder whether I understood even my father, whom I felt closer to than any man I have ever known. You like to tell true stories, don't you? He asked, and I answered, yes, I like to tell stories that are true. Then he asked, after you have finished your true story sometime, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? Only then will you understand what happened and why. It is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. Now, nearly all those I loved and did not understand when I was young are dead, but I still reach out to them. Of course, now I am too old to be much of a fisherman, and now, of course, I usually fish the big waters alone, although some friends think I shouldn't. Like many fly fishermen in western Montana, where the summer days are almost arctic in length, I often do not start fishing until the cool of the evening. Then, in the arctic half-light of the canyon, all existence fades to a being with my soul and memories and the sounds of the big Blackfoot River and a four-count rhythm and that a hope and the hope that a fish will rise. Eventually, all things merge into one, and a river runs through it. The river was cut by the world's great flood and runs over rocks from the basement of time. On some of the rocks are timeless raindrops. Under the rocks are the words, and some of the words are theirs. And then the famous final line, I am haunted by waters, which we can talk about in a minute. But I wanted to talk about something that I wanted to bring this up because of what you were just talking about, Heidi. There's these constant references in this section to the idea that people, that we don't really know people. The first bit that I said was, my father asked me a series of questions that made me wonder whether I understood him. So he's saying, I felt closer to him than any other man I've ever known. And yet here in this moment, I felt like I didn't know him. And earlier in the book, there's this bit where after they bring Neil back, he's talking to his wife and they have this connection or they have this conversation, but let's not lose connection, right? They kind of reset themselves. They reset their relationship. And when it seems like Neil is coming between them, when this sort of mini tragedy, well, I guess it's not a mini tragedy, but when this tragic moment that reveals, you know, Neil's true colors, no pun intended. When that happens, they stop.
His true color was red.
Exactly. They stop. Did he have a tail? But they stop and they make sure that they're connected, right? And so there's this for Norman, there's this constant pursuit of this sort of connection. There's something of Howard's End in this. But then his father asks him these questions and it's the questions themselves that throw Norman into this sense of like maybe he doesn't know his father like he thinks. And the way that he writes this is really interesting because a lot of the dialogue is in blocks of text, right? And he asks these series of questions and he says, why don't you make up a story and the people to go with it? But then the next two lines almost look like a dialogue, but I think they're all coming from the father, right? But it could be that Norman is responding with, only then will you understand what happened and why. And the father's responding to him next. So he separates out what has been throughout most of the book, blocks of dialogue. Like when one person speaks, it's a larger block. But then he breaks it apart as if it's multiple different people talking. And I think that almost is an objective correlative for the, you know, a formal representation of the way connection is so difficult. Like, that he talks about, his father says, it is those we live with and love and should know who elude us. And you were talking earlier about how Paul would go out and like the challenge of fishing, even when you don't catch anything was the point of it for him, or at least part of it. We obviously know he was pretty competitive, but I got to thinking about how he was fishing for that, you know, they're always fishing for that elusive giant fish, right? The biggest fish. And the idea that the fish are elusive is one of the crucial themes in the whole book. And that's the challenge. That's the thing they're always after. And it's what Neil's not willing to sort of pursue. But then here at the end, his father says that it's these people who we love the most and live with that are elusive, just like those big fish. And so it seems like Paul here is being compared to the fish who hides, you know, on the edge of the shore, who hides in the big rocks and who makes it difficult to catch. And so just as much as he is a great fisherman, a great skilled artist, he is also the fish who hides, who you look at and you see under the water. And, you know, they talk a lot about how you see his rainbow stripes under the water, and there's this brilliant color that happens, and it's mesmerizing, and yet you can't catch him. And so he's both the fisherman and the fish at the same time, which I think is a really profound way of expressing what you're talking about there, Heidi, and the way, and then how these things kind of merge together. And it like creates this extra level of hauntedness, because if the brother is both the fisherman who's waiting in the water trying to fish, but he's also the fish that's under the water, then it adds a deeper level of haunted of why he might, a deeper sense of why he might be haunted by the waters, because his brother's under there with the words that they were talking about earlier, right? When they're watching him fish, when he and his father are watching Paul fish, they talk about, what is it that he says about the word being under the water?
Yes. But under the rocks are the words.
Yeah, under the rocks are the words. And so under the rocks are the words, and under the rocks are Paul. And there's this everything flowing together into one, as he says. So I'm kind of wandering at this point, but this ending, you know, what he says here about the fish being elusive and all that was sparked by or brought up in my memory by what you were just saying there, Heidi. And there is this elusiveness to people. Like, how do you really know? You can't really know somebody. And like the constant pursuit of connection takes a lot of work, as you said.
Yeah, it's true. I think that's beautiful what you just said. This multiple layers of meaning within the language, within the images, within the relationships. It's like an invitation to engage with those divided spaces in our lives. But I think the redemptive image in that is that the river is full of life, right? It's not like a barren chasm. It's not empty. There's something that fills that divided space within our souls and with between humans. He talks about how the river becomes one, right? And I think that that's speaks to what you were just saying, David, about the fluidity of the images and the symbols within this story. That when he's talking about Paul, he's also talking about himself. He's also talking about his relationship with his wife. He's also talking about fishing itself. Like there's everything becomes one, and a river runs through it. The mystery runs through it. The division, the divide, but the divide is filled with something, and we can engage in that river. We can be in the river together. We can connect with each other. But to your point, there's still an elusiveness, a mystery to it that we can explore in our own individual ways. And I love the little sweet moments he has with his wife throughout the story. I think that that's
the
really
tense ones are kind of sweet.
They are. They love each other. Like there's that God is love, and he's talking about his family. And so there is an exclusivity to that, but there's also kind of a beauty to it that there's boundaries, secure boundaries within around this love. No one's stepping outside of it, even though there's loss and grief to it. There's still these connection points. Again, it's not a nihilistic story about how life is meaningless and full of despair. Like it is a story about love.
I love that moment where they bring in Neil back, and the women are all standing there, and he's just kind of fed up, and he's like, "Get out of my way." And they bring him in, and then she says it to him right back, like a couple of minutes ago, "Get out of my way."
And they just kind of,
they each get a chance to say it to each other, and then after that, they reconnect. There's something very real about that.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
Sometimes you both kind of say, get out of my way for a second, and then you come right back. I mean, I love the way he physically even describes that. They're standing in his, these women are standing in Paul and his way as they're bringing Neil in, and they say, get out of the way. And the women kind of part ways, like almost like the river, and they kind of walk between the women and bring Neil in almost like the river does. And then his wife says to him, get out of my way. And she goes and does something to help him out. But then they come back together. And just the there's a stagedness to that in a way that's sort of, I don't mean staged in a negative sense. I mean, there's a sort of cinematic, theatrical staging to the way,
there's a dramatic symmetry to it.
Mm. Yeah. I agree. Maybe. Well, and like a militant healing that the women bring to this story. That's like, you're going to take my brother fishing.
Right? Like, I love that. A militant healing. I love that.
They have this medical presence right there. They're healers, but they are strong women, and they force connection upon the men who don't know how to connect with each other. And that there is something very healing about that. And so anyway,
well, okay. So the book's constantly, or constantly touching on the idea that truly knowing another person is very difficult. Particularly the ones you love the most, because in some ways, probably your love keeps you from seeing them terribly clearly. But then at the end, it's all about everything merging into one, right? I mean, that's this big theme at the end of the book. All things merge into one. And he says, all existence fades to a being with my soul. So that in a sense, there's sort of an irony in this idea that throughout the whole book, knowing someone or being unified with someone or understanding someone is fading, and difficult. And yet at the end of the book, all things merge into one. So I want to touch on that quickly. Heidi, I know you got to go. Do you want to say something about this, and then Tim and I can sign off, or do you have no time at all?
Well, I can always send a text and say, I'm running late to teach my class.
I do want to say something and then go teach.
But I forgot the topic, so remind me of the topic. Well, I'm sure there's something to say.
No, I was just talking about how the book, through much of the book, it's about this idea that connection is difficult, but then at the end, the theme is all things merge into one. So right. There's a bit of irony there. So how do you sort of reconcile those in your right. own your own
there's
mind?
There's a paradox to it. And I think what is it that he says to his wife that they say to each other? That
get out of my way.
Right. Yes. And that's actually important and relevant. But there's something else. What do they say? We're not going to lose each other. Mm. Is that the phrase?
We're not going to lose sight. I think it's lose sight of each other. Something like we're not.
Right. I think part of the answer to the connection, I've been thinking a lot about this, the paradox of those things, not only in the story, but really in real life. That's true about my life. I mean, raise your hand if you feel fully known, even by the person who you're the most intimate with, right? Like probably no one's raising their hand. And I think some of it is the idea that we're all fishing at the same river, right? That Paul and Norman, even Neil and old Rawhide they're in the river. They're just exposed to the sun, and that damages them. But this idea that part of human connection is knowing, I do have to kind of fish alone, but we're in the same river. And
yeah, I think it's important that he's fishing alone at the end of the book.
It is important that he's fishing alone, and people tell him not to, but he does anyway, because in some ways he's carrying on what Paul has done. That's how they were raised. They were raised to be beautiful, and to be beautiful means to engage the paradox between nature and grace through this thin line that is your fishing line. Mm. And so, and I think that also the most enduring relationship that he speaks of in the novel is his wife, that they miss each other at the beginning. They're mad at each other. And then they say, they agree to never lose sight of each other. And he says, and we never have, and I still haven't lost sight of her, and she's gone.
Yeah.
Right. And I think that matters. Like I'll say, for me, that matters to know that there are people fishing in the same river that are like, I don't understand. Here I am.
Yeah. You know, I think that you mentioned Neil and Rawhide. They're even them there in the river, but they're kind of in a way like
anesthetizing themselves.
Yeah, like what's the opposite of sanctifying something?
Right, defiling it.
Yeah. They're like defiling the river. And I think that one thing, the book is this constant idea about oneness, right? Like unity, like things merging together. And that's why the husband and wife relationships, the two ones we have here, are very important. They're not talked about a lot, but thematically they're really rich because it's this concept of husband and wife becoming one, right? And in Rawhide and Neil, we have this sort of like, you know, in a way it's sort of this lowbrow comedy that gets dropped into the book. But I think it's there because it's meant to illustrate, you know, it's meant to, you know, there's kids listening, right? So in theory, so they're engaging in an action that mm-hmm. is meant to bring people together as one, right? Like through marriage. Right. But they're doing that.
It's so discreet, David. I love it.
They're doing that in a way that is defiling that yes. concept of oneness, right? And that's why, like, they're basically just like animals in the dirt, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And so that's to me their action of defilement is a kind of a lowbrow humorous bit in the middle of the book that is but it speaks very profoundly to the themes in this book, and the book is not the same without it there, you know. And they have to be, you know, the way they Paul and Norman talk about them, they talk about them, you know, they call them you know, I think they even use the word bastard, right? Like they call them very cruel things, they talk about them in a cruel way, they look down on them, and that has to be there for that theme to be as richly explored, I think. For the book at the end to be able to actually come and say all things merge into one, that theme has to be there, and there has to be a moment where it gets defiled for it to be more meaningful, if that makes sense.
Agreed. I gotta go.
Yeah, you gotta go. Tim and I will finish up here.
I'm so sad. I'm gonna have to go fishing alone.
Have a great class, Heidi.
Yeah,
thanks, guys. All right, bye.
All right, Tim, let's finish this conversation up then. Is there anything you want to, any final thoughts you want to add? We've been going for over an hour, so I think we're okay to kind of settle up here. We've got next week to answer questions as well. Do you want to touch on anything about this ending? Because Heidi and I got a chance to, but you've been patiently waiting the last 10 or 15 minutes.
I actually have a question, and I'm going to save it for the Q&A. It's for you and Heidi. It's a question about the end of the book. And every time I read this book, I always ask myself, what happened? And I don't know if I should like tease the question now.
Like what happened in the book?
And ask it. And like, yeah, there's a specific thing, description of something that happened. It's not a thematic thing. It's an event that's not, he doesn't really, we don't know the reason why this event happened. I'm wondering if I should ask you now, and then we can kind of like pick it up next week. Maybe, or if I should just save the question.
You could ask it, but we won't answer it this week and tease it for the next episode.
Okay.
Next week.
Okay. Let's do that.
On Close Reads. It's like the trailer for the next episode.
Right. Okay. So for me, here's the trailer. 102 in my book. Mm-hmm.
So we're right at the end.
He's talking to his father. Right at the end, he almost reached the door. This is his father. And he turned back for reassurance. Are you sure that the bones in his hand were broken? He asked. And I repeated, nearly all the bones in his hand were broken. In which hand? He asked. In his right hand, I answered. So we don't know how all of the bones were broken. Like we understand that Paul was killed by these men that he was indebted to, but we don't know exactly how. And his father makes a guess later on in the book, like maybe he was ambushed and he came out fighting, but we don't know the answer. And I have always wanted to know, why were all of the bones in his right hand broken? I have a couple of guesses, but I think they have to remain guesses because I don't think the text tells us. So I'm curious what you and Heidi think those two, what do you and Heidi think the reason might be that all of the bones in his right hand were broken?
I think that the book at least implies why, but I think there's a reason why it doesn't come right out and say it. Which I think would be
fun
too. Like, what's his? I think he's making an interesting authorial choice there. So, all right, well, that's a good place.
Yeah, I think so too.
Tim, this is it's a great book. Thanks for pushing all this time for it. I know it's one of your heart books. So,
oh, absolutely.
See a little bit why.
Thanks for. Oh man, every time I finish it, and I'm just so full. It's just such a rich book.
So, would you say it's like, say you had a Mount Rushmore? Is it of heart books? Is it up? Is it on the Mount Rushmore? Or is it in the top 10, or where do you kind of place?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely top 10. Maybe it's top 5. And gosh, I don't know what else I would put. It'd be a fun list to put together. Books that are both really good, but they also just kind of like touch us in these really deep ways. It's definitely in Rushmore.
I really like this idea that you created of a heart book, because when we talk about, you know, what are your favorite books, I think there's often this inclination to try to figure out, well, what are my favorite books that are just that everyone knows are universally great? But the heart book kind of allows you to
say,
what are the books that just mean a lot to me? You know, it kind of gives you the freedom.
Yes, absolutely.
The books that I turn to for comfort or for encouragement or for a challenge, or, you know, they just are the books that are, they're mine, you know, and it's a little bit of a different
thing.
What are your favorite books, or what are the, because when you say favorite books, there is an inclination to say, well, okay, Anna Karenina, I mean, that could be your heart book, but, you know, or Huckleberry Finn or Hamlet or something, because they're universally beloved and I like them, right? But it's a little bit of a different question.
Yeah.
So I like
it is a little bit of a different question. We're reading another one of my heart books this season on Close Reads. We're doing The Sun Also Rises.
Yeah.
Which I have a feeling that when we get to it, there are going to be a lot of people that are saying, they're going to say, this is one of your heart books, and I will come
guns
ready to offer an apologia. Yeah.
Well, those are the best shows sometimes when one person,
I think so.
A little bit of conflict is good, right?
Like Sarah Jane really loves another one of the books that we're doing this season, Frankenstein. I can barely read that book. It drives me crazy. So I think you and I, David, talked about, like, maybe I can come on and issue my complaints, you know, about the book. And by the end of the book, maybe they'll have been answered.
Yeah. And we'll have an interesting little conceit for the way we structure our conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, speaking of conversation, hope everyone will join the conversation. Don't forget that you can send your questions to us on the Facebook page. That thread will go up as soon as this episode goes up. And then also, of course, you can email them to us, closereadspodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget about the Patreon, patreon.com/closereads. You can support the show. It's how we pay our editors, pay Tim and Heidi, and pay for the hosting of the podcast on all the apps and everything. And that will also allow you to join the conversation as we discuss Crime and Punishment starting at the end of January. So we are beginning to prep for that already. So we are looking forward to that. I guess that's it, Tim. Another great book finished. Although next week we will answer questions, but man, every time we finish a book, little piece of, you know, I was going to say a little, I was trying to think of how the most like dramatic way I could put it, but I can't really think of anything right now. Little piece of the podcast life dies and plants fall seed.
Yeah, right, right.
Plant new podcast life.
Nice. Way to go, David. You salvaged it.
Well, Tim, we'll see you this weekend. So looking forward to that. To everyone who's been listening, thanks so much. We really do appreciate the conversation. Appreciate your support, and we appreciate you spreading the word. So as Tim said at the top of the show, those reviews and those ratings really do help us out. So please, please, please do that if you are an Overcast listener or wherever you listen to podcasts. For Tim, for Heidi, for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening, and happy reading.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.